Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is a wondrous man, Doug Dowd, age 94. Imagine that. Still active, still vibrant, still writing books, still writing articles. Oh, I hope I could do half of what, if I get to that age, I hope I can do half of what he's doing now. Through the late 1990s, he was an economic historian at Cornell, at UC Berkeley, and elsewhere. It went right along with his activism and progressive thinking. His latest book is titled Inequality and the Global Economic Crisis. His latest article is called U.S. Capitalism and Militarism in Crisis. Until recently, Doug was teaching part-time in Bologna, Italy. I'll have to check with him to see. We're trying to get him on now. I wonder if he's still doing. I think maybe he is not doing that now, but I'll ask him. But into his 90s, he was teaching part-time. It got a little bit too much for him to go full-time. And I think, as I remember, he had a pretty hefty commute back and forth from home. I mean, that is really a chore for anybody. And to do it into your 90s, that shows commitment. I've read lots of Doug's books. I've read them over the years. They're on my shelf. It really is special for me to be able to have him on. I haven't had him on for a while, and I really look forward to today. I hope we connect easily. He said he will he will be shaved. He will have a necktie on. He will be all ready to come on air. I said, well, Doug, you know, you don't need to do that. I'll probably be unshaven. I'll be in casual clothes. And, of course, we're doing radio, no video. Ideas matter most, and that's what we stress on this program. Information, the truth, most important issues, that's what this program is all about. That's what Doug is all about. So much going on, including in Italy. They had a very dramatic election some weeks back. A man by the name of Grillo, rhymes with Brillo, surprised things. An independent candidate, hard to tell what they really would do if they managed to get any kind of power. But he sure said the right things. He went after the system. He called it a lot of things accurately. You know, predatory and taking advantage of people, militaristic, neoliberal, the rest of it. He was a comedian. A comedian turned politician. He got about 25% of the votes. He came out of nowhere. Still trying to reach Doug. Hopefully there won't be a problem trying to get him. Maybe he's a little delayed. It really was a marvelous election. They still, I mean, some time has passed now, and they still have not formed a government. It'll be a coalition government, and according to what Grillo said during the campaign, he's not about to cave to the people who support the things that he's against. Well, it remains to be seen. You know, talk is cheap. Policies mean everything. I stress all the time in my writing, on air, on this program, in interviews, ignore what the politicians say, watch what they do. I wrote three times on Obama's trip to Israel. The media praised him, the things that he said. He gave a major address at a Jerusalem convention center. A lot of young people were present. The rhetoric was lovely. Too bad it doesn't mean anything. Well, I wrote an article I put out this morning. I called Obama in Jerusalem. I wrote one that, I forget my title, sometimes I write so many of them. I think the first one I wrote was Obama heading to Israel, then Obama in Israel, and the most recent one, Obama in Jerusalem. He picked the wrong place to go. America does not have its embassy in Jerusalem. It has it in Tel Aviv. Jerusalem is an international city. It was established that way by the UN in 1947. It has not changed. Israel claims it as its exclusive capital. Palestinians rightfully claim East Jerusalem as its future capital. They absolutely have a right to it. No country has a right to claim Jerusalem as its exclusive capital or as its capital now. It's an international city. So why did Obama go there? I said he shouldn't have. He shouldn't have come in the first place. He came up to no good. He came supporting Israel. He does it one-sidedly. He spurns Palestinian rights. Protests across the West Bank happen. He spent token time in Ramallah, the headquarters of the PA, Palestinian Authority, a coup d'etat authority. The real Palestinian government resides in Gaza, There was an election in January 2006. Hamas won it overwhelmingly. They're the legitimate government. They're not recognized. They're boycotted. They're isolated. And what's done to them is illegal. You never hear anything about that in the mainstream media. You do in my articles. If they were democratically elected, they deserve to serve. Well, Hamas officials in the West Bank, or Hamas representatives, people affiliated with Hamas, Israel harasses them. The PA harassed them. Many of them were arrested. A good many of them are still languishing in Israeli prisons. They didn't do anything. They violated no law. They committed no crime. But at one time, over 20 of them were in prison for supporting the wrong party. I call that a crime against humanity. Oh, we got Doug on. I'm getting so wrapped up in my own comments. Doug, I welcome you to the program. There is so many things that I address. You heard a little bit of my addressing Obama in Israel, but I want to let you jump in. I gave you a glowing introduction, and it really is wonderful having you back on the program again. Doug, are we connected?
Hello?
Doug, can you hear me?
Yes, this is Doug.
Welcome.
Well, hi. Who's this, Steve?
This is Steve.
Yeah, okay.
We are live on radio on the Progressive Radio News Hour. I see a little message from my studio. You were expecting a call an hour from now?
Yes, 7 o'clock, he said, 6 o'clock.
Ooh, I know what the problem is. We shifted to daylight time 2 weeks ago.
Oh, well.
Okay. I guess you haven't caught up with us yet.
I happened to walk into the house when the phone was ringing, so it was lucky. Okay, I'm away. Let's go.
We're all sitting ready to go. I think you go on daylight. Italy goes on daylight time, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know what Italy's on, but I know that in Italy it is 6 o'clock at night, not 7 o'clock.
It's 6 o'clock in Italy. Well, it hasn't gone on daylight time yet. We moved ahead an hour, and I didn't take that into consideration. I should have double-checked. I assumed that Italy moved the clock ahead an hour as well, which would have made it 7 o'clock. Anyway, we're connected.
Anyhow, that's not what we want to talk about.
No, we don't want to talk about that. I did want to ask you one thing. I mentioned in my introduction that at least until recently you were teaching part-time. Are you still teaching?
I was teaching in Italy until I quit last month. I quit a month ago because I had to go there on a train. It's a train ride from here, and it's very difficult. It's very dangerous to get on and off the train these days, especially for an old guy like me. So plus the fact that my mind is slowly but steadily going away, so I decided to quit before they would hang me. I was teaching for over 60 years, so that's enough.
Well, to teach well into your 90s, Doug, I would say that really is quite an achievement. And I said in my introduction, I hope if I make it to your age, I can do half of what you're doing now. You truly are a wonder.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to teach those all those years.
Oh, indeed.
In many ways.
And you kept in touch with some of your former students.
Oh, certainly, yes. As a matter of fact, quite a few of them. Although more of my students are dead now. They haven't lived as long as I have. But anyhow, it's been a very good life. And I'm still writing, and I'm not teaching anymore. But in order to write, I don't have to take the train or anything like that.
I think it's a wonderful way to stay young. I'm just a pup compared to you. I'm 78, but I write all the time, every day, and do lots of media work, this program, and lots of interviews that I do. And it really is a tonic. It helps keep me young and energizes me. And I look forward every day to getting up and doing more. And it really is amazing. I hope I manage to keep my health, and I can do it for many more years. I just can't imagine anything I want to do more than this.
Yeah, you probably would hang on. Don't worry about it.
Well, you take it. You live your life day to day, Doug. But let's talk issues. There's so much going on in terms of imperial wars and neoliberal harshness. And there's just so much that's so disturbing. And you wrote about it recently in a couple of articles and in your new book. Talk about the things that most concern you.
Yeah. Well, I'm writing a new article right now, which is even more scary than the others. You know, and you'll get it. Anyway,
have you given it a title yet?
It's not the United States. One of the things that I don't know, we're not on the program yet, are we?
Oh, we are. We're on air.
Oh, I see. One of the things that's very important is that in the past we talked about a world economy, but there was no functional world economy until the last 40 years or so. Now it really is the case that virtually every nation in the world, all the big nations and most of the small nations are connected with the trade and production of all the rest of the world. So that, for example, right now in the news they say that Europe is in trouble, but the United States is okay and so on. Europe has gotten in trouble partly because the United States was in trouble before and so on. And it goes around and around like that, and it's very, very serious. And on top of it being serious in and of itself, it's even more so because virtually every country in the world, every meaningful economy in the world has leadership which is conservative. And, I mean, for example, you probably know, Britain and the United States both insist upon seeing to it that the primary situation that they want to deal with is to keep the value of the dollar or the value of the pound stakes. You know, in other words, they don't give a damn what happens if they have to put up with unemployment and so on and so on. That's okay. The value of the dollar or the pound is more important, and this sort of thing is carried to almost all countries now, one way or another. It's very, very scary. Very scary. Yeah.
Well, it is very scary, Doug. And there is this nefarious alliance, the NATO countries and the NATO partner countries. Together, they comprise about a third of the countries in the world, and they prioritize imperial wars. And of course, you got the banker-dominated societies. They prioritize what I call neoliberal harshness. I just wrote my third article on what's going on in Cyprus. I'll write an article and get it out the next day. My first article I called Grand Theft Cyprus, and the second one was Grand Theft Cyprus Part 2. And the one I put out today, I wrote it today and got it out. I called it High Noon in Cyprus. I felt that I had to get it out the same day I wrote it because things are happening so fast that what I wrote may change the next day and what I wrote won't be applicable, so I'll have to write a new article. So I wrote it and I got it out right away. It's on my blog site. I sent it out to some web editors who might be interested in it. And what we're talking about is just plundering this small island state of Cyprus in the Mediterranean, population of about 1 million people. And the issue is always the same, whether we're talking about Greece or Portugal or Italy or Spain, any of the countries in Europe and America, the bankers get paid first. And ordinary people, popular interests don't matter. And this is policy, and it's causing so much harm to so many people. So that's one issue. Financial war, Doug. Financial war, waging financial war on humanity. And, of course, the other issue is hot wars. And, of course, they're raging in many, many places. And America is behind all of this, allied with Britain, other NATO partners, with Israel, with key belligerent countries, causing so much harm to so many people, either financially or militarily or any other ways, and it really is a deplorable situation. It's not getting better, it's getting worse.
Yep, I agree. We agree. Unfortunately, the thing we're agreeing upon is really very, very dangerous, very worrisome, and getting worse and worse every day and spreading all over. And it's just what's going on in the little countries is that they're being hit hardest First, because they have little strength to handle it, but it's just a terrible situation we're in, and that's what I'm writing about right now. And I don't see how it's going to change. I mean, for example, although the president of the United States is not one of the worst people, he can't. He's up against the Congress. They won't let him do anything that's necessary to do, even the Senate. But the United States at least has a reasonably decent president. But if you look at Britain, you look at Germany and so on, France has a reasonably decent leader also. But things are all connected. Every nation is now connected with all others, buying and selling and producing and borrowing and so on and so on. It's just a hell of a mess. And it's very difficult to see how it's going to be made safer unless it's from the bottom up, that is to say, from the people. And the people, unfortunately today and understandably today, the ordinary person is more involved with debt than with politics and so on and so on. It's a very dangerous period.
It really is a dangerous period, and you've got embedded power systems that really run things, and the core of the power is money power. Whoever controls money controls everything. So, and across Europe and in America, you've got dominant parties, Doug, so it really doesn't matter all that much whether a party that calls itself liberal or conservative, they're all conservative. I mean, Democrats in America aren't really any different from Republicans, and whoever sits in the Oval Office in America, whether it's Bush or Obama or anybody, that person is beholden to the power structure, to duopoly power, to money power, and they're well vetted before they're even selected to be a nominee. They'll either go along with the system or they won't be chosen. And I wrote and I've said that that in large measure, the U.S. election last year, I worried more about Obama being elected than Romney. I thought Romney would end up being hated like George Bush, so at least there'd be public outrage about the things that he was trying to do. And I don't think he could do as much as Obama. But Obama is a smooth-talking con man, and after all the harm he's caused, complicit with both houses of Congress, half the country still supports him. I mean, it shows that people simply don't know what's going on. I understand that they're concerned with the daily things in their lives. They're important, work, family, the rest of it. It's important. But their overall welfare is important. And you said what I repeat all the time. Ordinary people alone can change things. It'll never happen any other way.
Well, ordinary people don't have the access to reality in terms of the kinds of things, whether they read the newspapers or most of the magazines or listening to news over the radio. They're not getting anything like the real situation. They're getting something that's either tied down or a set of lies, as the case may be. It's very difficult for a reasonably decent person to get reasonably important information. You have to be somebody going out looking for information, and the average person doesn't do that. They're expecting to get it through something just that happens in their newspapers or their magazine. And we're in a very dangerous, very modern process now. And unfortunately, one very important part of that modern process is that the political life of the populations in almost all countries is now contaminated or suppressed or whatever. It's a very worrisome time, as far as I'm concerned.
Doug, I agree with you that most people like to get their news and information passively. They don't want to make any effort. And it really isn't that hard with a minimal effort. I mean, anybody connected online, 15 minutes a day, and they could know enough to realize how they're being harmed so much. 15 minutes a day, but instead they turn on their TV set and they just sit back and they eat snacks or whatever, and they think that they're getting informed about what's going on. They're not, as you say. They're getting propaganda. They're getting managed news misinformation. They simply have no idea what's going on, and the most important things aren't even reported. You get some of it in the major newspapers. The New York Times covers a little bit of it, but they do a deplorable job. They're basically part of the system. I'm a severe New York Times critic. I know they know about me. I do critiques on them so often. I take them to task on the things that they say that simply aren't true. And I love to take them point by point on key points, say what they say, and then have a section I call Fact Check. I wrote an article a couple of months ago. I called it Open Letter to New York Times Editors. I have no idea how well it's read because I don't keep track, but there's one website that posts for me, and they keep track of their all-time read articles, and I was astonished that on this one website, which is certainly not one of the best-known ones, this article has attracted over 43,000 readers. It has to be by far the most well-read article I ever wrote. Well, it struck a nerve. It really made me feel good to think that, gee, there really are this number of people. There really are more than this number of people. But this number of people found my article. It shows that a lot of people understand that they're not getting the straight stuff from the major media.
A
you
lot
can't
of people,
get it
but by no means enough people. And you can't blame the people who are out of touch with the kind of work that you all do. The whole system is, in effect, taught people not to look at the right places or the left places for information. Most people's information is gotten by them in the easiest possible way and the most popular way. And unfortunately, it's information is misinformation rather than real information. The people can't be blamed. It's the people are a product of a society, and a society is producing people who, quite consciously, the people who are in power are also doing their very best and doing very well at it to produce people whose minds are all screwed up by the kinds of things that they read and kinds of things that they can't read and so on. This is a very different period from anything I've lived through, in the sense that the things that are so worrisome are very high percentage of them have been constructed deliberately for people to be misstruck, to have their minds screwed up. It's a very dangerous period, more dangerous than anything I've ever lived through. And I lived through a lot of war and so on. And that's the other thing that's going on. There's just no question at all in my mind, and I think it's just a reality that in addition to the fact that the politics are dominated by big business, very big business, it's also true that the big business is very, very friendly with the military because they make a lot of money out of it, among other reasons. And the political power that big business has, which they could use to lessen militarism in the United States, in fact, they support that militarism. And how are the people going to find out? Well, if they look in their newspapers, they're never going to get the full truth about anything. You know all of this sort of stuff, and I think the people who listen to your programs know it also. The problem is that the people who do that, you and I and they, are a tiny, tiny minority. And it has to become a substantial minority. In fact, it has to become the majority. It has to become a majority over time. And it's really, to my knowledge, and of course I'm out of the country, but I do keep in touch with the country, to my knowledge, there's very, very little in the way of promising politics going on in the States. There was, of course, what started a couple of years ago, but that's being suppressed or knocked out or drifting away. If I were in the States, I don't know what I could do. I'd look to the city of Hitler and whatever. To find out with whom can I go to work? I don't know. Maybe you could probably have good answers to that.
Well, there's so much. Indeed, I agree with you, Doug. I really agree with you. I'd be happy, short of a majority, if there were a large enough minority of really committed people. I was very excited by the Occupy Wall Street movement here, and it's still around. I think there are good, committed people in the movement around the country, but you don't hear so much about them. Of course, they were targeted. The police went after them city by city. Homeland Security went after them, the FBI, the rest of them. When any group sprouts up, the power structure goes after them to target them, to remove them. It's very much alive, but it just hasn't had the resonance that I hope for. I hope in some
way.
It's
very much alive, but it has had to climb up a very steep hill with very little assistance. But that doesn't, I don't think that they're going to give up. You know, the big question is how are other people going to join them? In large numbers. There has to be a political, popular, political movement for the people. And I mean, the Democratic Party is just about as corrupted as the Republican Party, so there does have to be something else. And it can't be done in a short term with another party. It has to be done with ordinary people, seeing that they can control the existing parties, and get people in Congress and so on, and work their asses off to try to see to it that there's a decent society. And that's just simply not one of the criteria for people in the United States, or for that matter, in most other countries now. The criteria have to do with buying things and borrowing for them and then paying off the loan, paying off the debts and so on and so on. And it's also true that militarism has become such a norm. I think if there were no wars going on in the world, most people would just be absolutely surprised at what the hell, what kind of world is it anyway? It would be a very different world. There's never been a situation as dangerous economically, politically, and militarily as right now. And it's a time when political participation has to be greater than ever it has been in the past. So we're looking at a very difficult situation. But that doesn't mean we should give up. It just means we should work harder. It's always true.
Well, we can't give up, Doug. We really can't. And there seems to be a much greater spirit in Europe. Lots of protests, lots of people very upset. Certainly, it's very active in Greece. It's active in Cyprus right now. And there's a good bit of commotion in Italy. You had a very important election some weeks back. A man by the name of Grillo surprised people. What's the latest on what's going on there? I worry that the rhetoric, the political rhetoric, gives way to political reality once an election is passed and people make compromises they shouldn't make, so the policies end up entirely different from the rhetoric. What do you make of this man, Grillo?
Well, he's a very effective guy in terms of being able to get people to support him. But what they're supporting when they support him is a guy whose politics are at best fuzzy. He has the people who have been supporting him go from right to left. You understand? There are people who are all angry with what's going on in reality, but their anger is not anger with, say, capitalism. It's anger with something else. He himself is not a politician in any serious sense. He is an entertainer. An entertainer you can't trust. I mean, as far as he's got people's attention, that's all he gives a damn about. He doesn't care whether he's moving right, left, or middle. When he first began to work, I was amused by it. And when he first began to work politically, I was amused and then interested and then hopeful. But what he's doing, since he's gotten a lot of votes and so on, what he's doing is nothing seriously about what needs to be doing, and he's more dangerous than he is helpful at the moment.
Well, that worries me.
What has to happen is that the major party on the middle, that is not on the right, has to get its participants have to go to work, see to it that in Congress the basic and necessary policies are pursued. And one of the things that's really ominous in Italy is that the worst politician they've had in the last 50 years has been elected and reelected three times and would be reelected again if it were legal, but he can't because the law that he's in God. But he's still got the power. So what's happened is that the people have been tripped over, been cheated, have gone up in a society which is essentially insane.
Doug, they sure have. The music says, let's take a quick break. Hold that thought. We'll come back to Italy. We can talk about Mario Monti, Silvio Berlusconi, the rest of it. But we'll take a quick break and come right back. Welcome back. Talking with Doug Dowd from Italy. Doug, we were talking about Italian politics, and you certainly have not had the best in Europe or any place else with the kind of leaders that have served as head of state. Berlusconi, the media magnate, he was convicted on some charges. Well, he's rich enough to drag those out for the rest of his life. I can't imagine he'd spend one day in prison or jail or anything else. And then you've got an unelected prime minister who was resoundingly defeated in the last election, Mario Monti. I like to call him three-card Monti, this former Goldman Sachs international advisor, whatever his capacity was, but he's a banker, and he wasn't elected, and Berlusconi was, I guess, asked to make way for him to take over. So you've got an unelected guy who now was defeated at the polls. I don't know what his fate will be going forward, weeks after the election, there's still no government. How is Italy being governed today, Doug?
Well, it isn't being governed. It's difficult, really, for people to realize what's going on, because what is going on is something that is unique, at least unique in the last 50 years, and that is that the political situation is. The kind of leadership that's going on now is going on because of the kind of people who put it into office, and the reasons they got into office, and the reasons are really very disgusting and worrisome. There's such a diversion from reality, from a diversion from truth about the society that's going on in politics, and not just in Italy, but in the United States and Britain and so on. That is going on in a world in which political involvement, serious political involvement, taking up time, is something which is really quite rare now. And I think it's not sufficient for people like us to just keep complaining about that. What we have to do is to go out and do everything we can to get as many people as possible to get involved in politics, and to understand that involvement is an involvement that takes up a lot of time, takes up a lot of energy, takes up a lot of hope on the basis that where it's difficult to be hopeful. And it's just... It isn't impossible that things can be changed for the better. I mean, as you know, I'm an old, very old guy, and during the Depression of the United States in the 1930s, I was in my teens, and if somebody had asked me about how things are going, I probably would have been saying something very much the same thing that I'm saying now, except that there was something different there, and that is something very different. The working class was essentially without unions, and it was in a desperate situation for poverty, with politics over them which didn't give a damn about the average person. But in that situation, and this is a good thing to know, in that situation, which when looking at it from afar, you would say, well, no hope at all, that situation was exactly the thing that, which created the beginning of a really serious good people's movement in the United States. A people's movement that functioned from 1934 for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then unfortunately because it was functioning well, it became less politically involved, and we went back into bad politics again, and it brought out into good politics only after World War II. Well, we can't have another world war that won't destroy the whole world. So people in the United States, and I would say also in Italy and Britain and France and so on, have to understand that there cannot be a good life unless it's a life that is very, very political, much more so than they ever would have imagined for themselves that they should be doing. And I think that, just as I had very little hope in the early 1930s, which was wrong, it's very wrong now, I think, possibly wrong, to think that we don't have a chance to create political organizations all over the country that will see to it that we get, as soon as we can, we can't do anything very big very soon, but as soon as we can, to try to get different people in local politics, different people in the national politics, get different people in Congress and so on and so on and so on. At the same time, keep organizing, having political meetings, which is normal to attend, even though Jacob takes some time, and it might even take up a little money. The people have to understand that unless we devote ourselves to politics in some meaningful degree, we are saying, okay, the door is open to hell, and so here they come. And that's about all I have to say about this. It's just it's a desperate situation where people have to change living the way we're now living. It's not a time for thinking about how can I have a good time. And that should be on the edge. Having a working time political should have to be right in the middle. So that's what I think.
We're responsible for our own welfare, Doug, is really what you're saying. People need to be involved enough. Nobody's going to protect them. Nobody's going to go out of their way to do anything for them. And the way things are today across the Western countries in Europe, in America, in Canada, whatever countries did for their people in the past, these things are being swept away in America, the New Deal, Truman's Fair Deal, the Great Society. Republicans and Democrats are allied together to destroy these programs. They want to target the biggest ticket items, the ones that they falsely call entitlements, like Social Security and Medicare, and they absolutely are not entitlements. Using that term really demeans what they are. They're insurance plans. Everybody who works pays premium. It comes out of every paycheck. These are obligations of the federal government. But you'd never know it the way Republicans and Democrats talk about it. When Obama first took office early in 2009, he targeted Medicare. He gave an interview to the Washington Post. I quoted him verbatim. I repeated it a couple of times. Once in an article I wrote, maybe a couple of months ago, where he said point blank that he especially talked about Medicare. He didn't say much about Social Security in that interview, as I recall. And Medicaid is a welfare program for poor people who need health care. If they don't get it that way, they're not going to get it. So the government does something for them. But that's being curbed. That's being cut. And Medicare has been cut for a long time. But Obama targeted, he said, we simply can't afford it anymore. Well, of course we can afford it. We can afford it if we use the funds that are paid in to pay the expenses that go out in medical care. We can afford it if we don't wage wars, if we prioritize the nation's resources to do popular things, to benefit the country, to build the infrastructure, to provide vital public services. There's plenty. If the richest country in the world can't afford these things, Doug, then what country can? So saying it's unaffordable simply is a canard. It's a lie, but it gets repeated all the time. And you get Obama saying it. So the Republicans, of course, say it all the time. But you get a Democrat president that half the country believes. So people may think that maybe we can't afford this stuff. But we can't afford it.
You certainly can.
We can't afford not to have it, is what he should say.
We cannot afford a war for several obvious reasons. One, not just money, but because we're in a war. And what we're job doesn't mean anything if you're going to have wars on your hand, because the next wars are going to be the wars that end all wars, end everything, because all the weaponry will be used. It's just the whole thing. People simply have to begin to pay attention to reality, and all that we can do, if people like us who say the same thing can do, all that we can do is to get out and do spend an enormous amount of our time trying to organize people to be good working people politically, at home, in their localities, and for national politics. And it's a difficult job, seemed to be an impossible job, but it seemed impossible in 1932. And then it was the ways in which to organize politically these days are much easier than they were in the 1930s. So people just have to get to work and recognize if they don't, they are responsible for the kind of mess that they're moving into, we're all moving into. That's about all I can say about it.
Well, it's very, very true, Doug, and I agree with you that another war could be literally the war that really will end all wars, because there'll be nothing left to fight wars over.
That's right.
We're
going to get through it. 10 years from now, it's about all we've got, I think, before the war, the end of all wars.
I wonder if we have that long. I've said that I wonder whether humanity can survive Obama's second term.
10 years is the maximum. I didn't say we can't drive, but that's the maximum.
That probably is the maximum.
Terrible moment.
It's a terrible moment. I call it the most perilous time in world history, and I don't make that statement lightly. And I like to repeat it often because I think it's such a true statement.
I agree with you.
We're both old enough to remember when we thought things were pretty rough and dangerous, but it was nothing back then compared to today. World War II was nothing compared to today. I mean, U.S. cities weren't attacked. I mean, people lived normal lives during World War II. I remember World War II. I'm old enough to remember. I remember all of it. I don't remember the moment it started. I was only about 6 years old or 5 years old. I think it started about the day I entered kindergarten, so I didn't know what was going on then, and there was no television, and the only thing I really recall was when my dad came home from work. He wanted to turn on the radio to get the news. He had his favorite commentators and so on. All I wanted to do was listen to Superman and Captain Midnight and that kind of stuff. Well, that's what kids like, so I didn't understand it, but I gained a little bit of understanding as I got a little bit older, and the war went on, and a good number of my relatives were in the war. They all came back, thankfully. But I realized there was a war raging, and by the time it ended, I certainly understood enough about the war to realize that this was one bad thing. I had no idea how much worse it could be ahead, or the fact that literally war would rage every single year in one way or another after World War II ended, the big one in Vietnam, Korea, of course, Truman's War, and Vietnam, and one thing after another, whether in Africa and Central America and the wars that are raging now. Post 9/11, Doug, it really got very, very serious and dangerous, and that's the stuff that worries me, along with police state laws at home that I've written a great deal about. So we've got homeland repression combined with neoliberal harshness combined with imperial war that don't show signs of ending. They show signs of continuing and spreading. And what happens in one country can spread regionally, can spread globally, and that's when we get in real, real big trouble.
Yeah, well, what you say about the war, you didn't know much about it when you were well, just a kid. Well, when the war ended, I was paralyzed. I was in hospital in the Philippines Island, paralyzed. I couldn't move. And when I got out of that hospital and I got back out of the Army, one of the first things that I did was begin to help organize a political party, a political group, which would fight against war. That was my response to the war. And we became not just against war, we became a political party that was against everything that was wrong with the United States. And it worked pretty well for about 10 years. And then things began to get better again, and people slowed down and looked the other way. We have to recognize that to be a human being is to be a kind of person, a kind of idiot, a kind of can be easily defected from being serious, right? Because you can have some fun by not being serious. And we have to understand that we can't have anything unless we get serious. We keep the rotten things, the dangerous things, from taking over completely. And I'm pretty much of an expert on war weapon and how to use it and so on, followed it. And I would say, I would confirm what you're saying. The next war will not be just the last war. It will be the end of life on the world. It's not a joke. It's not a guess. It's almost a certainty. And the people in power don't give a shit one way or another about that. As long as they're making business and doing what they want to do the way they want to do it, they don't give it a damn. And they have bought and paid for, I would say, something like 80% of the Congress, including Democrats, not just Republicans. So
you're coming in a little jumbled, Doug. Doug, there's one point I would like to raise. Days after 9/11, the Congress passed an authorization for the use of force. It passed unanimously in the Senate. In the House, only one member of the House voted against it. So it was a near unanimous vote that gave the government the right to wage aggressive war against an enemy of America. Of course, America didn't have an enemy at that time. It invented an enemy. It claimed that Osama bin Laden and the Taliban and Saddam Hussein were in some way responsible for the 9/11 event. Of course, they had nothing whatsoever to do with it. But practically the entire Congress, 535 representatives, there may have been a few abstentions, or maybe a couple who weren't in the Senate or the House to cast a vote. But of all the ones that were there, we'll say 534 voted for war and one voted against this blanket authorization to wage war without America having an enemy. I mean, that shows how belligerent America is and how we live on really a knife's edge of going to war with anyone. And the Bush administration established a preemptive nuclear strike policy built into official policy, preemptive strike against any nation for any reason that America considers them an enemy, including a non-nuclear state, and Obama continues the same policy. That is a prescription for disaster.
Yep. Well, we've got to do as much as we can to change the whole situation. And you're doing some good work, that word. You're in a good position to keep doing it. And I'll just say thank you for pulling me into this situation so that I can do what little I can do, which is quite little. But everyone has to do everything we can politically, but to see to it that we're not going on our way to complete destruction. That's about all I have to say.
Doug, you're a role model for me. Over the years, I've read maybe a dozen of your books, and they inspired me so much. I never imagined that I'd be doing what I'm doing now. I wanted to be informed, and one way that I felt was best to be informed was by reading books by people like you. I had to discover you, first of all, and when I discovered you in one book, I had to read another and another and another, and they're on my shelves. I consider them my treasure, and I found other wonderful, distinguished scholars and academics, people who really care and said the right things, and this is what matters most to me. And then accidentally I got into what I'm doing now, and I can't imagine any other way. We're just about out of time. Any final thoughts?
My final thought is that and there are two people who are doing it, but the more we are doing it, the more you people are doing what we're doing. So thanks a lot for asking me, and keep up the good work.
Doug, it was a great pleasure and a great honor for me to have you on, and a real pleasure. And again, I hope I can be doing half of what you're doing if I'm ever lucky enough to reach the ripe old age where you are. And I hope maybe you'll pass the centennial mark, and we'll have a special program with the only centennially
aged. That's one of the funniest things I've ever heard about passing centennial. I'm not working away for that. I'm just going along, enjoying what life I have left and not worried about when it's going to end. Anyhow, thanks a lot for asking me.
Thank you, Doug.
Good luck with the whole thing.
Thank you so much. I just remind listeners that, of course, we're on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We're on weekends, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I failed to calculate the difference between Chicago, where I live, and Italy. I thought they were on daylight time now, so I told Doug that we'll come on at 7 p.m. his time. It's only 6 p.m. I guess they haven't sprung forward as yet. I think they do it in Italy. I know, I remember from the past that Britain delays going on daylight time compared to America. I should have checked, and I didn't, but we connected with Doug okay. We'll have another wonderful program tomorrow. I will have a guest, unusually, who happens to live in Chicago. We have guests from all over the world, from America, from other countries. And tomorrow I'll have a Chicago-based guest. His name is Bill Ayers. Join us tomorrow. Make it a regular habit.